This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I have the honor tonight to introduce Michael Pollan, a prophet in his own time. Wow, I've just finished reading the book that can change our world, if the world will only change its way of eating. Reading The Omnivore's Dilemma, we discover a humane and healthy way to live. In its pages, we find new confirmation of so many concerns that have arisen in the past 100 years as our food chain growing more and more remote and industrialized. Recent studies, for example, show how the production, processing, packaging, and transportation of food may now be contributing up to 1/3 of the greenhouse gas emissions each year. Michael has written a work of investigative and narrative journalism by calling on many skills, the position of a scientist, the passion of a lover, the nostalgia of a romantic, the curiosity of a wanderer, the commitment of a teacher, the courage of an adventurer, and the outrage of an activist. And to top it all off, he's a darn good wordsmith. He writes sentences that stick with me. He creates images that I can't forget, be they sly and humorous. His description of the cliffs and canyons of snack foods in the supermarket, or horrifying, such as his confrontation with blood spreading like a river delta. Like most of you, I'm meeting Michael for the first time tonight, but I feel like I've been on a very long journey with him, a road trip through supermarket aisles and rows of corn, my feet muddied with rich earth, as well as the horror of the feedlots. I've met through him farmers that made me lie on my belly to look at the healthy grasses and insects that cover their land. I met others through this book that feel as victimized by the state of industrialized agriculture as you and I do as the consumer end. I've had my eyes opened and my stomach turned. I'm left empty and hungry by modern-day food stupidity. Yet I'm fuller than ever before with the information I need and we all need to save the way we and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren eat. In my many years in the health and fitness field, I've seen the effect that fresh, organically grown food can have on the body, on the mind, and just as importantly, on one's relationship with nature. When we began Rancho La Puerta in 1940, we started with an organic farm. My husband brought his knowledge of growing healthful food with him from an earlier stay in Nice. And when Sir Albert Howard's work, An Agricultural Testament, reached our hands, we embraced the concept with even greater enthusiasm. In those early years, Rodale, the founder of organic gardening as we know it, and Gaylord Hauser, and all the health nuts of whom I am proudly one, came and visited us. They all agreed the health of a nation and its people begins with the health of its soil. Then as now, knowing what you are eating and relishing every aspect of the astonishing story that brought that carrot, that pea, that quivering leaf of lettuce to the brink of your lips is essential to health and happiness. It is also essential to the survival of the world as we know it. And Michael makes that case with unforgettable power and persuasiveness. I trust that by now you've had time to read Michael's interesting biography in your program. He is much honored for his previous work. His book, The Botany of Desire, was on everyone's must-read list. Now, The Omnivore's Dilemma is a must-read of even greater magnitude, especially among those who love the earth, as we here tonight do. Reading it, you will feel that, yes, we can do it. We can change the world by eating locally and seasonally and respecting the soil, the water, the sunlight, and all the natural wonders that make the miracle of good food ours for the picking. Now we know scientifically what we inherently knew so long ago. all carrots are not created equally. Please join me in welcoming Michael Pollan, author of The Omnibus Dilemma.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Deborah, for that beautiful introduction. One of the nicest I think I've ever heard. Thank you. Well, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks to Dan also and to the Revell Forum and to UCSD and to the Neurosciences Institute. It's great to be in this beautiful hall. I was thinking while I was in the green room, what does this subject have to do with neuroscience? And I'll just leave you with one fact that I just stumbled on the other day, which is that we have as many neurons in our digestive system as we do in our brain. I'm not prepared to venture a theory. What I am prepared to do today is tell you a little bit about the journey that this book was for me, how I came to write it, and the surprises that I encountered on the way, because this was new territory for me. I was I'm not an expert on this subject, or I wasn't, and I'm not a food journalist. I think of myself really as a nature writer of a certain kind, a nature writer who's always been drawn to a particular arena in which to look at the human relationship to nature, which is to say I'm really interested in the messy places. I got into writing about nature as a gardener, and I was more interested in trying to figure out what we could learn about our relationship to the natural world in the garden, as opposed to where Americans usually go when they want to study nature, which of course is historically and wonderfully, we have a great tradition of going to the wilderness. The kind of the tradition of Thoreau and Emerson and John Muir and Gary Snyder in our own time. And that wasn't for me. I don't like to go camping very much. So I needed to find another place to write about nature. So I started in a garden, and I've also written about architecture, and which is actually about nature as well, the kinds of materials we turn into our spaces, and also what we learn about our bodies as we study what makes us feel good in a place. There is nature there, too. And drugs, I've written about drugs, and that is obviously one of the more interesting places that species and compounds in the natural world affect us, and we affect them. And so it in a way, in retrospect, and these things always make a little more sense in retrospect than they do in prospect, coming to write about food was kind of inevitable, because food, eating, represents our most profound engagement with the natural world. There's nothing else we do that has as profound an impact on the landscape and on the composition of species, other species, we share this planet with. Through our eating, we determine which species will thrive, ones like the cow, the chicken, the pig, and which will not. So that is, and then of course the impact on the landscape, which is profound. So, you know, as much as we're coming to appreciate the powerful impact of human civilization on the climate system, we have had a comparable impact for thousands of years through our agriculture. So in a way, it was kind of a natural place for me to gravitate as someone who was really interested in sort of grappling with this very tricky issue of how we fit into nature. How are we part of natural systems, and how do we stand outside of them, and how do we screw them up, and how might we make them better? So food was in my future. The proximate inspiration, though, for doing this came in, I really started this book in 2002, and those of you with long memories will remember that something very strange happened in 2002, and that was that overnight, largely as a result of a single article in the New York Times Magazine called "What If It's All a Big Fat Lie?" by a science journalist named Gary Taubes, America changed the way it eats overnight. we had the low-carb craze of 2002-2003, which is just now releasing its grip on our diets in the supermarket. And this struck me partly as a lover of bread and pasta, as a an invidious development, as but how was it, and I was on the East Coast then, I've since moved to Berkeley, that foods with as long a pedigree, you know, human staples as old as bread and pasta, could suddenly have been transformed into toxins. And, you know, it occurred to me that this is very unusual for a whole culture to change its diet overnight, to go from this fear of fat to fear of carbs. And the whole food system, as you know, is re-engineered to reflect this. Pasta got a makeover. Bread got a makeover. Or it, by and large, just disappeared from many, many tables. And it occurred to me that that said something about America's attitude toward food. Because if you think about it, most cultures, what they eat is actually one of the more stable things about them. And there's something wrong with a culture that, on the basis of a single piece of journalism, or as often happens, a single scientific study or fad, will change the way it eats. It suggests that we're kind of not anchored in our eating, that we do not have that kind of deep, steadying influence of a food culture to guide us. And I realized that we had something of a national eating disorder. Not any particular trend, but the fact that we had trends was the problem. So it got me very interested in this question of, well, okay, what should we eat? What should I eat? Very simple question. And a question, of course, that doesn't trouble too many people on this planet, and certainly doesn't trouble too many species on this planet, other species who pretty well know what they should eat. It's either hardwired or they have these various cognitive tools to help them sort out the good stuff from the bad stuff. And that's what I meant by the omnivore's dilemma. The omnivore's dilemma is the basic predicament of all generalist eaters, okay? Species who don't just eat one thing. You know, the cow knows what to eat, it's grass. The koala bear knows what to eat, it's eucalyptus. There are no issues. And in fact, because there aren't any issues, they have very small brains. Their genius is in their gut, that they can actually get everything they need to survive out of such a meager diet of one thing or two things. If, however, you're a generalist, like us, and our fellow generalist species, the company's not so great. The cockroach is another generalist, and the rat is another generalist. You need some other techniques. You need some mental equipment. And the rat has a very interesting set of mental tools for this. I don't know if you know much about how rats choose their food, but they're very, very clever about it. What they will do is they'll have a little nibble of everything, but one thing at a time. They'll conduct a little experiment, and they'll taste something and then wait a half hour and see what happens before they have a second bite. And if they feel sick, they form a lifelong aversion to that food. And if they don't, they chow down. It's one of the reasons it's very hard to poison rats. You've got to mix the novel food in with something familiar to them that they don't have a lifelong aversion to, because they will learn that your poison is poison. I had said in the book, actually, and I got this wrong, that, you know, well, we have a real advantage over the rats because, having figured out what's a good food, we can pass it on to others, and that every rat has to work this out for themselves. But in fact, that's not true. A scientist sent me a couple sites for some research that suggest that when rats find a good food, they go over to the rats in their family and they breathe on them. And they can learn that that's an acceptable food from another rat. So there is a little food culture in the rat world. I don't know if they can pass it down the generations. But we have this other wonderful thing, though. We have a fully developed food culture. And when we taste something bad and something kills us, we give it a really clever name, like, oh, say, the death cap mushroom. You know? don't eat that one. And we learn that and we pass on that information. And then even very improbable foods like lobsters, we've passed on the word that that very strange-looking, inedible-looking thing is actually quite tasty. And every generation, we don't have to go through that process of trying a lobster for the first time. So that's how a food culture begins. But to go back to my earlier point, I was suggesting that it's not quite working in America right now. And it's not quite working in America for a lot of reasons that I wanted to explore. So that was the basic question, what do you eat? How do you decide what's good, what's bad, if your culture is not really telling you in any kind of reliable way? And I would argue, and in fact I'm going to argue this at greater length in my next book, science is not, has not been a very reliable guide to what we should eat. Science, by and large, has blown it for the last 30 or 40 years, with the help of government and industry. But we're very quickly learning that the whole lipid hypothesis, as it's been called, this idea that the key to eliminating chronic diseases such as heart disease and cancer and dealing with obesity is to get off of fats in the diet, has not held up, is not true. The science suggested, in fact, that that was a huge mistake that no one in the medical community or the government has dared come out to tell us, because I think that they would be very embarrassed. But in fact, if you read the scientific literature, everybody is like backing up from that proposition as fast as they can. And that's indeed part of what that article I mentioned that started this whole process was about. So to answer this question of what we should eat, though, I realized I first needed to answer an even more fundamental question, which is, well, what the hell am I eating? And because I realize in America that isn't so clear. Most of us don't know what we're eating. We don't know where the food comes from. If you're eating an industrial diet, this is food of such surpassing opacity that it's very hard to figure it out. I mean, what is a Twinkie? Does anybody really know? Actually, there's a whole book out now called Twinkie Deconstructed that walks you through all 39 ingredients, many of which are very obscure. So I went looking. I decided the thing I needed to do was to follow the food chain. Very simple premise. I would take a few foods in the industrial food chain, as I call it, but also then in the organic food chain and the local food chain, and follow them back to the place where all food begins. And most of us have even forgotten where that is. But of course, everything we eat begins with photosynthesis. Whether you're eating meat or vegetables, it begins with a plant somewhere, and it might be in the water in the form of algae, gathering sunlight and combining that sunlight with the energy in that sunlight with carbon dioxide taken from the air, a few simple minerals in the ground or in the water, and turning it into carbohydrate, into food. All food chains begin there. So what would happen if you took that McDonald's meal, right, that Big Mac or chicken nugget or soda or salad, and followed that back? Where would you go? Where would you end up? And I decided to do that for a couple things, and that was the journey. And the first surprise, as I followed that industrial meal, and by the industrial meal, I do mean sort of fast food and the kind of food that you can get in the middle of your supermarket, all that processed stuff that's not on the edges. You know, the fresh food's on the outside, but in the middle is this kind of kingdom of highly processed, very profitable foods that, you know, never go bad. Somebody once had a priceless bit of nutritional advice that I'm sure Deb remembers, which is, don't eat anything that doesn't rot. And believe me, I have a Twinkie. Having written about the Twinkie before, I have a Twinkie that's been sitting on my shelf in my office, and it's as spongy as the day I bought it 2 years ago. It's incredible. So where would the industrial food chain lead me? And I start with the industrial food chain. And every section of this book, for those of you who haven't had a chance to read it, is about a meal. And I followed a McDonald's meal back to the farm. And I'm going to read you a couple brief passages just along the way to punctuate my talk and give you a little bit more flavor of the book. But let me read a short passage that gets at, and it's one that Deborah alluded to, that gets at where that first food chain begins. When I started trying to follow the industrial food chain, the one that now feeds most of us most of the time and typically culminates either in a supermarket or fast food meal, I expected that my investigations would lead me to a wide variety of places. And though my journeys did take me to a great many states and covered a great many miles, at the very end of these food chains, which is to say at the very beginning, I invariably found myself in almost the exact same place, a farm field in the American Corn Belt. The great edifice of variety and choice that is an American supermarket turns out to rest on a remarkably narrow biological foundation comprised of a tiny group of plants that is dominated by a single species, Zea maize, the giant tropical grass most Americans know as corn. Corn is what feeds the steer that becomes the steak. Corn feeds the chicken and the pig, the turkey and the lamb, the catfish and the tilapia, and increasingly even the salmon, a carnivore by nature, that the fish farmers are re-engineering to tolerate corn. The eggs are made of corn. The milk and cheese and yogurt, which once came from dairy cows that grazed on grass, now typically comes from Holsteins that spend their working lives tethered to machines eating corn. Head over to the processed foods and you find even more intricate manifestations of corn. A chicken nugget, for example, piles corn upon corn. What chicken it contains consists of corn, of course, because that's what they feed the chickens, but so do most of a nugget's other constituents, including the modified cornstarch that glues the thing together, the corn flour in the batter that coats it, and the corn oil in which it gets fried. Much less obviously, the leavenings and lecithin, the mono, di, and triglycerides, the attractive golden coloring, and even the citric acid that keeps the nugget fresh can all be derived from corn. To wash down your chicken nugget with virtually any soft drink in the supermarket is to have some corn with your corn. Since the 1980s, virtually all the sodas and most of the fruit drinks sold in the supermarket have been sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. After water, corn sweetener is their principal ingredient. Grab a beer for your beverage instead, and you'd still be drinking corn in the form of alcohol fermented from glucose refined from corn. Read the ingredients on the label of any processed food, and provided you know the chemical names it travels under, corn is what you will find. For modified or unmodified starch, for glucose syrup and maltodextrin, for crystalline fructose and ascorbic acid, for lecithin and dextrose, lactic acid and lysine, for maltose and HFCS, for MSG and polyols, for the caramel color and xanthan gum, read corn. I tried to read that sentence in Denver and I couldn't get to the end of it. Corn is in the coffee whitener and cheese whiz, the frozen yogurt and TV dinner, the canned fruit and ketchup and candies, the soups and snacks and cake mixes, the frosting and gravy and frozen waffles, the syrups and hot sauces, the mayonnaise and mustard, the hot dogs and the bologna, the margarine and shortening, the salad dressings and the relish and even the vitamins. And yes, it's in the Twinkie too. There are some 45,000 items in the average American supermarket, and more than a quarter of them now contain corn. Actually, the number is much higher than that. This goes for the non-food items as well, everything from the toothpaste and cosmetics to the disposable diapers, trash bags, cleansers, charcoal briquettes, matches and batteries, right down to the shine on the cover of the magazine that catches your eye by the checkout. Corn. Even in produce, on a day when there's ostensibly no corn for sale, you'll nevertheless find plenty of corn in the vegetable wax that gives the cucumbers their sheen, in the pesticide responsible for the produce's perfection, even in the coating on the cardboard it was shipped in. Indeed, the supermarket itself, the wallboard and joint compound, the linoleum and fiberglass and adhesives out of which the building itself has been built, is in no small measure a manifestation of corn. Now the question is, what about us? If everything we're eating is corn, are we corn too? And I have to report that, in fact, we are. I have a friend on campus who's a Mexican-American biologist, and I was telling him about my research and how much I'd learned about the importance of corn in the American diet. And I said, you know, I'm starting to think, you know, Mexicans call themselves the people of corn. They have for hundreds of years. That we're more the people of corn than you are. Because in Mexico, you know, they don't feed animals. They don't feed cattle corn. They think it's sacrilege, or they did until very recently, to feed corn to animals. And they also don't sweeten their sodas with corn syrup. They use cane sugar. In fact, they make a real point. If you go to a Mexican neighborhood, you can still get Coca-Cola with sugar. And I recommend you try one. They're much, much better. And he said, well, and this is the beauty of working with scientists, instead of just having these literary conceits you can throw around, they say things like, well, you could prove that. And I said, really? And he sent me to another biologist on campus who has control over one of the mass spectrometers at Berkeley. And I went to talk to him, and he said, oh, yeah, well, you can find basically the signature of the carbon in anything. And if it comes from corn, it actually has a very distinctive signature. The ratio of isotopes is a little bit different. I don't have to get technical about it. But he said, if you give me a fingernail or a hair clipping, I could put it in the machine and tell what percentage of the carbon that person is came from corn. And you can see I've done a lot of these experiments in recent years. He said you could do the same thing with a hamburger or a soda. And this got me thinking. And we did some experiments. I teach a class called Following the Food Chain at Berkeley in the journalism school. And we did working with a couple of the students, we took a McDonald's meal and we put it through the machine, in effect. And it was kind of remarkable. The soda, 99% corn, all the carbon in it, you know, take out the water. The carbon is high fructose corn syrup. The Big Mac was like 56% corn. The chicken nugget was 60-something percent corn. And we worked our way down. Even the Paul Newman salad dressing was like 80% corn. It's all corn oil and high fructose corn syrup, I might add. It's not a recipe he should be proud of. And this was the big surprise. The French fries were 30 or 40% corn. I was like, huh? But, of course, the oil they're fried in, which is where they get a lot of their calories or carbon, is very often, and it depends on any given day, corn oil or some blend of vegetable oils. So when you're eating a McDonald's meal, even though there is no corn on the menu, you're eating corn. And the same is true for a great many of the industrial foods that we eat. It all comes down to this one plant. Now, you might ask, well, so what? You know, what's wrong with eating this corn-based diet, even if we don't know it? And I would argue that there is a couple problems with it, two that I want to talk about very briefly. One is an environmental problem. When you are basing your entire food system on so few crops, and corn's not the only one. The soybean is right up there, and wheat is pretty high up there. But we're getting about 80% of our calories from just four different crops. But when you're doing that, you are, if your diet is such a monoculture, your farm fields will be a monoculture. And to grow that much corn, and we are now having this year 100 million acres of America will be planted to corn. The only way to keep a monoculture like that alive is with vast amounts of fertilizer, because it's a very greedy, nitrogen-needy crop, and pesticide. Because if you grow anything in such abundance in monocultural fields, nature generally destroys monocultures. Pests go crazy when they see a monoculture. It gives them such an opportunity to multiply their numbers that growing things monoculturally can only be done with great amounts of industrial chemical. And indeed, that's what we do. Most of the pesticides we use go on the corn crop. Some very nasty pesticides, including atrazine, an herbicide that is sprayed on 70% of the cornfields in America. This is a chemical that we know, it's been banned in Europe for this reason, but not in this country, that at amounts as small as 0.1 part per billion in the water will turn male frogs into hermaphrodites. They will begin to develop female sexual organs. And this pesticide is all over the water table in the Corn Belt. And then there's the nitrogen pollution that washes down, you know, out of the fields because farmers put on way too much and it doesn't stay put and it ends up in the rivers and means that women in Des Moines, which drinks from the Des Moines River in the spring when there are big runoffs, get blue baby alerts. You're not allowed to use the water to feed your babies because the nitrites in the water, or is it nitrates, I forget, compromise the ability of the red blood cells to carry enough oxygen to the brain. And this nitrogen pollution washes down the Mississippi all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, where it has created a dead zone that is the size of New Jersey and growing. This is an area where very little can live because of the lack of oxygen. It's a hypoxic zone. That is basically we're turning, you know, a large part of the Gulf of Mexico into this wasteland, this maritime wasteland, in order to keep our monoculture of corn growing. So you see, putting all your eggs in one basket agriculturally is a very bad idea. And that's one reason that we should be eating a more diversified diet, because then we could have more diversified farm fields. The other reason, though, in the same way that monocultures are really bad in the land, they're really bad in the diet, too. You know, we are omnivores. We need somewhere between 40 and 100 different distinct chemical compounds, minerals, to be healthy. That's just the way we're wired. And you can't get that from a diet of heavily processed corn, soybean, and wheat. You can only get that if you're also eating lots of plants. With the result that we have people in this country, and especially when you go to the inner city, that are overnourished, at least in the sense of having so many calories that they're overweight, yet are undernourished in terms of they're suffering from serious nutrient deficiencies. There are clinics in Oakland, near where I live, where children come in, overweight, who are suffering from rickets, which is a vitamin D deficiency, that we thought was pretty much eliminated 100 years ago. The reason for that is they're drinking more soda than milk. They're drinking corn and not milk. So eating this way is not wise. We need to diversify our diets. We need to diversify our farm fields. And they're connected. As Deborah said, the health of the soil is connected to the health of the people. And this is something that health nuts, as she mentioned earlier, were telling us 50 or 75 years ago, and now science is coming to support. So that, you know, to be very brief about it, this corn economy, which I follow through feedlots and the processing companies that make the high fructose corn syrup, I won't go into that in any more detail, is a very interesting and disturbing food chain. But this was a book that I didn't want to end in despair. I really wanted to explore the alternative food chains because now we have them. We have wonderful alternative food chains today. It's a much happier story than the global warming story or any number of other stories that I might have told. And I thought it was important to shine a light on some of the successes. So I went looking for alternatives, and I did a lot of work exploring organic. And organic is a complicated story. A lot of great things have happened, but organic is getting big, and in various ways it's being compromised. And I want to read another brief passage, also involving a visit to a store. This one, though, is a visit to Whole Foods, which purports to give us the alternative to the corn economy, and in many ways it does. But there's some surprises there. So you guys have a Whole Foods here? Yes. So surprised. And I call this section Supermarket Pastoral. I enjoy shopping at Whole Foods nearly as much as I enjoy browsing a good bookstore, which, come to think of it, is probably no accident. Shopping at Whole Foods is a literary experience, too. That's not to take anything away from the food, which is generally of high quality. Much of it's certified organic or humanely raised. Oh, when I go like this, it's a quotation, because there are a lot of quotations in this. Or free range. But right there, that's the point. It's the evocative prose, as much as anything else, that makes this food really special. Elevating an egg or chicken breast or bag of arugula from the realm of ordinary protein and carbohydrates into a much headier experience, one with complex aesthetic, emotional, and even political dimensions. Take the range-fed sirloin steak I recently eyed in the meat case. According to the brochure on the counter, it was formerly part of a steer that spent its days living in beautiful places, ranging from plant-diverse high mountain meadows to thick aspen groves and miles of sagebrush-filled flats. End of quote. Now, a steak like that has got to taste better than the one from Safeway, where the only accompanying information comes in the form of a number. The price, I mean, which you can bet will be considerably less. But I'm evidently not the only shopper willing to spend more on a good story. With the growth of organics and mounting concerns about the wholesomeness of industrial food, storied food is showing up in supermarkets everywhere these days. But it is Whole Foods that consistently offers the most cutting-edge grocery lit. On a recent visit, I filled my cart with eggs from cage-free vegetarian hens, milk from cows that live free from unnecessary fear and distress, wild salmon caught by Native Americans in Yakutak, Alaska, population 833, and heirloom tomatoes from Capay Farms at $4.99 a pound, one of the early pioneers of the organic movement. The organic broiler I picked up even had a name, who I'll bet some of you know, Rosie, who turned out to be a sustainably farmed, free-range chicken from Petaluma Poultry, a company whose, quote, farming methods strive to create harmonious relationships in nature, sustaining the health of all creatures and the natural world, end quote. Okay, not the most mellifluous or even meaningful sentence, but at least their heart's in the right place. In several corners of the store, I was actually forced to choose between subtly competing stories. For example, some of the organic milk in the milk case was ultra-pasteurized, an extra processing step that was presented as a boon to the consumer since it extends shelf life, but then another more local dairy boasted about the fact that they had said no to ultra-pasteurization, implying that their product was fresher, less processed, and therefore more organic. This was the dairy that talked about cows living free from distress, something I was beginning to feel a bit of myself by this point. This particular dairy's label had a lot to say about the bovine lifestyle. Its Holsteins are provided with an appropriate environment, including shelter and a comfortable resting area, sufficient space, proper facilities. You kind of imagine like bathrooms or something, right? But this is my favorite. Proper facilities and the company of their own kind. Now, how many dairies do you know that don't offer that? It's not the problem on feedlots. All this sounded pretty great until I read the story of another dairy selling raw milk, completely unprocessed, whose cows graze green pastures all year long, which made me wonder whether the first dairy's idea of an appropriate environment for a cow included, as I had simply presumed, a pasture. All of a sudden, the absence from their story of that little word seemed weirdly conspicuous. As the literary critics would say, the writer seemed to be eliding the whole notion of cows and grass. Indeed, the longer I shopped at Whole Foods, the more I thought that this was a place where the skills of a literary critic might come in handy, those and perhaps also an investigative journalist. So I spent some time following these foods back to their homes, and one of the ones I followed was Rosie, the organic free-range chicken. And I'll tell you briefly about my encounter with Rosie, or rather the 20,000 Rosies that, because they had the company of their own kind, occupied a vast barracks-like shed near Route 101 in Petaluma. You know, the bag Rosie comes in, if you take a look at it, has a very pretty kind of 1930s-era farmhouse with a picket fence and a silo and animals running around in the yard. But in fact, Rosie comes from a factory farm. It's better than a lot of factory farms, but it's still a factory farm. And there's a series of these barracks, each with 20,000 Rosies, and or Rocky's, her brother, who's not organic, who has the same lifestyle except doesn't eat organic grain, and it gets a little bigger. Because I'm not sure why, actually, but Rocky is bigger than Rosie, and the people at Petaluma Poultry let me come tour, and actually on two occasions, and they were very nice about it, and I give them a lot of credit for that, because there's a lot of big food producers in this country who will not let a journalist, which is to say your surrogate, into the kitchen to see how your food is being prepared. And one of the things, however much you want to criticize organic producers, even the big ones, they tend to be much more open to journalists and to letting you visit. And I think that that's very important. Transparency is a vitally important measure of and a device for getting accountability in the food system. So they had me there. So I go out there, and I have to don this biohazard suit before I can go in, this paper thing with the hat and the little white booties, and because, of course, since they're organic chickens, they can't be given antibiotics, so they're very worried about them catching a cold. So we step in, and this huge white cloud of chickens just kind of moves back and then kind of moves forward again in this wave. And it, you know, smelled like ammonia, as you'd expect, and very close. But the first thing that occurred to me is, all right, what's with the free ranging? I don't see any free ranging here. And outside there was this lawn, basically, this 15 feet wide. I mean, this thing was 100 yards long, this shed. 15 feet wide, ran the whole length of it along one side, but it was empty. There were no chickens in it. And I asked the farmhand, so what about the free ranging? And he pointed to a little door at one end, and there was apparently another door at the other end. And he said, that's how they get outdoors. I said, yeah, but the door is locked. And he explained that, well, you know, we don't let them out right away because we're really afraid they'll get sick because they're not on antibiotics. So we wait till they're 5 weeks old before we open the doors. And I said, okay. And then how long do they live? You know, when do you slaughter them? And he said, oh, 7 weeks. So I realized then that the whole free range thing was not so much a lifestyle for these chickens as a 2-week vacation option. But in fact, it's an option that very few of them take because not being accustomed to going outside with the food inside and the water inside, they're not going to go outside, and they don't, very seldom. So, you know, free range is not all it's cracked up to be. Does that matter? Well, if you've ever had pastured chickens, if you've ever had pastured eggs, you know it does matter. The product is infinitely better. Chickens that get to eat grass and eat bugs just are a whole lot tastier and indeed a whole lot healthier. They don't need antibiotics. So that was my kind of encounter with one little corner of what I call big organic. And as I say, this is still a superior product compared to a Tyson's chicken or, you know, some of the other really big producers. But organic, I think, is at a certain risk of putting forth a pastoral image that it can no longer really support. In some cases, not all cases, but in some cases. So I kept going, and I'm going to end with one more little adventure I had, which was to find a farm and a farmer that was really kind of, you know, walking the talk. And I had been looking. I was writing an article about industrialized organic for the New York Times Magazine, and I was looking for a farmer who could be very critical and give me some salty quotes about Whole Foods and big organic and everybody kept saying, well, you've got to talk to Joel Salatin. Joel Salatin is a meat farmer of various kinds in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. And I called him up, and he describes himself as a Christian conservative environmentalist libertarian lunatic farmer. And he's all those things. He's a very complicated, very interesting, very intelligent man. And he just went on about the organic industrial complex and, you know, the organic empire represented by Whole Foods. And I got all these great quotes from him that I used in this article. And then at the end of the conversation, I said, you know, I hear you grow wonderful pastured chickens and grass-fed beef. And I wonder if maybe you could send me some. And he said, no, I can't do that. And I figured he wasn't set up for shipping because most of his sales are local. And I said, well, I could have the FedEx guy come with the dry ice and the styrofoam box and everything and give you the you know, my FedEx number. And he said, no, you don't get it. I don't believe it's organic or sustainable, if you will, to FedEx meat across the country. It's one of my more embarrassing moments as a journalist. Yeah, I guess it isn't so sustainable to FedEx meat across the country. He said, if you want to try my chickens, you're going to have to come down here to Swope, that's where he lives, and get them here, because I only sell locally. I only sell within 50 miles of my farm. And that was his, you know, very important principle. So I did go there. I went there twice, and I had a kind of amazing experience. I worked as a farmhand for a week, and I described that week here, which was, you know, in terms of the physical labor done in this book, the hardest that I did. The hardest mental labor was understanding the farm bill. But the hardest physical labor was being a farmhand for a week and keeping up with the other, you know, the 20-year-old farmhands, and sleeping in a little trailer that, you know, I'd never slept in a trailer, but everything is scaled down in a trailer. You know, not just the rooms, but, you know, even the beds. And, you know, I get into this bed the first night, and it's really hot. I'm there the last week of June, and the bed is only 5 feet long, and I'm 6 feet long. And so I slept very badly, and I worked very hard. But I learned something very interesting, and I had a kind of a large surprise there. And I just want to describe how that came about, and then stop to take your questions. But Joel grows, with his son, Daniel, grows six different species, at least. He's got chickens, both broilers and layers. He's got beef, grass-fed beef. He's got rabbits. He's got pigs. He's got turkeys. Sometimes he has sheep. And I think that's it. Is that six? That's seven. And he grows them all. He has 100 acres of grass, open grass, very hilly area in central Virginia, and then another 400 acres of woodlot, and former corn farm, bad area to grow corn. When he got there, or his dad got there, the soil was so eroded that you could see rock outcroppings everywhere. It's not a good place for row crops because it's too hilly and not quite enough rainfall. And he and his father have set about kind of healing the land for all this time. And what's interesting about what he does, though, is he grows all his animals in a rotation, a very intricate system, almost an ecosystem, such that every animal is performing some ecological service for another animal species, and that there's really this kind of dance of symbiosis that's quite an intricate and beautiful thing to behold, much of which he kind of thought up himself. There are many different examples of these relationships. I want to focus on one of them. When I first got there, I like animals. I used to have a pet pig when I was a kid, and I was eager to go meet the livestock. And he says, you have to meet the most important species on this farm first. And he walked me out to a pasture, and he told me to get down on my stomach, as Deborah mentioned, and introduced me to the grasses. And because I had asked him, I had said, well, so what do you call yourself? Are you a cattle rancher? Are you a chicken farmer? Are you a rabbit farmer? And he said, no, I'm a grass farmer. And I never heard that expression before, a grass farmer. Why would you farm something, unless you're growing sod for golf courses, why would you farm something that we can't use or eat? And he explained that the grasses are the keystone species in this ecosystem. And so we got down on our bellies, and he explained to me how the grasses, the different species, and of course we say grasses, but there's, you know, 40 or 50 different species in a square foot very often. And there were worm castings, and it was a nice springy pasture. And he explained to me a little bit about how it worked. A little later in the day, we went up to move the cattle. He grows his grass-fed beef in a rotation with his chickens. In this particular paddock I'm going to describe, his laying hens. The way he does it is he's got this herd of cattle, and they'll spend one day in a paddock, which is just a little pasture, only a quarter acre. And they're grazing intensively, but only one day. And he sets up the pastures with this cheap electric portable fencing, which is the key technology here in this otherwise very low-tech system. You need this kind of fencing to make it work. So at the end of every day, he goes up to move the cattle. Now, many people when they hear move the cattle, they're picturing this very difficult process that involves several pickup trucks, a bunch of dogs, some chewing tobacco, a lot of screaming, maybe a little lasso, you know. It's not like that at all, because they move every day, and they know the drill. And so we get up to this area, this pasture, and we set up another paddock for them next to the old one. And this fencing is kind of remarkable. It's plastic poles and this wire mesh, And I could carry a quarter acre's worth of fence on my shoulder and set it up in 15 minutes by myself. And I was a complete idiot. And you plug it into a car battery, and you're good to go. So we'd set this up, and then Joel kind of opens the gate, basically opens a piece of fencing between the two, and the cattle, and I describe in the book that he looks, you know, less like a cowboy than a maitre d'. And he swings his arm like this, and the cattle all move into the next paddock, and they're very happy to get there because that's where they finish the grass there. That's where all the good, green, sweet grass is, because all day long the grass has been building up sugars to get through the night. So that's when, if you're going to eat grass, that's the time to eat grass. Take that eating tip from me. And so they go next door to the new paddock, and they're happily munching, and they'll spend the 24 hours there. Then what happens is very interesting. He waits 3 days, and he tows in this really ramshackle contraption he calls the Henmobile, and it is basically a portable chicken coop that looks like a prairie schooner. And he made it himself, and it's got a metal roof and laying boxes along the sides, and he tows that in early in the morning. On the third day, into the paddock that's just been evacuated by the cattle, and lowers the gangplank, and 300 laying hens come streaming down the gangplank, clucking and gossiping as chickens will in the morning, and they fan out over this quarter acre, and they make a beeline for the cow patties. And what they do, and what they want, is the grubs, the larvae of insects that are in those cow patties, and that's part of the parasite cycle on a farm. That's why you have flies, is that basically you have maggots that pass through the animals and then hatch, and then you have more flies. But the chickens will eat a great number of these grubs. It's their favorite food, and it's their source of protein. And the reason he's waited 3 days is to grow those grubs as big and juicy as he can. But if he waited 4 or 5 days, on the fifth day, they hatch. So he has to understand the cycle of this parasite. With the result that 3 days is safe, and so that's when he moves after 3 days. And they go through, and they are just digging through the manure, getting their grubs, spreading it. So that's another service they add. So he calls them his sanitation crew. So that's how he doesn't have to use... He doesn't have to use insecticide on his cattle. There are no parasiticides because the chickens are taking care of it. So you see, it's a very different model than that industrial organic, where your goal is to eliminate pesticides so you can call yourself, or antibiotics, pharmaceuticals, so you can call yourself organic. So you go to great lengths and you keep everything clean and you wear your hazmat suits and you keep the door clean just to keep your animals from getting sick. Versus his model, whereas the model allows you to dispense with these chemicals. It's a byproduct of the system, not the goal of the system. So anyway, so the chickens, they're eating the grubs, they're spreading the manure, and of course, they're fertilizing the pasture. Their manure is very high in nitrogen, and he knows exactly how many days at a given time of year 300 chickens can be on a quarter acre before there will be too much nitrogen, because chickens can really damage a grassland. And then he moves them to the next paddock. And then what happens is kind of remarkable. And now we have to go back to those grass plants I was describing. The grasses with this fertilizer are then left alone for 3 to 6 weeks, depending on the time of year, and they go through this blaze of growth. And what happens, though, before the growth starts is very interesting. When you graze a grass plant, and now we're going to go close up on one grass plant, when a ruminant comes along and shears it, the plant does something very significant. It basically sheds a corresponding amount of roots to however much leaf mass it's lost, because all plants like to maintain kind of what's called a root-shoot ratio. And if you're a gardener and you transplant something and you disturb the roots, you've got to get rid of some greenery or it won't be able, there's not enough roots to support the top. So to stay in balance, the plants essentially kill off a corresponding amount of their roots. And those roots die and they decompose. And all the microorganisms in a healthy soil set upon those roots and digest them. The worms, the nematodes, you know, all that wilderness of stuff that's in the soil, and turns that those roots into new soil. And that's really how soil is created. It's created from the bottom up. That's how the prairies, the 6 feet of topsoil in the Midwestern prairies that we started with, was all about that relationship between the ruminants, the buffalo who graze that, and the grasses. And soil, that's how we create soil. And I didn't understand that at all. I didn't know soil came from the bottom up. And that's when I realized that what's going on this farm, and then 6 weeks later he'll either bring back the cattle or he'll bring in another animal or and start the whole process over again, that this model is a challenge to all our most tragic assumptions about our relationship to the natural world. Which is to say, we assume, and we have many reasons to believe, that we are in a zero-sum relationship with nature, such that for us to get what we want from nature, nature is diminished. When we get food or energy or entertainment, there's more for us, less for nature. And that's how most of our agriculture works. We diminish the soil to get that huge corn crop, whatever it is. What he is suggesting with this kind of system, and he's not the only one doing this, but it's where I saw it most dramatically, is that there is a way to get what we want from the earth, and he gets a huge amount of very high-quality animal protein from this soil. I mean, 40,000 pounds of beef and 25,000 pounds of pork and 50,000 dozen eggs. I don't know, the numbers are all in the book. A lot of food from this 100 acres. At the end of the season, there is more fertility, not less. There is more biodiversity, especially in the soil, not less. There is more soil, not less. So this process feeds us and adds to the world and heals the land. And that's when I realized that, you know, this zero-sum idea isn't our tragic lot. It's our choice. It's the way we've been doing things. And there are other ways to do it. And there are farmers that are showing us the way. And it's up to us to support them. And so I urge you to find your Joel Salatins in this community, and I know they exist. And I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.